Good morning, good morning. Happy New Year. Happy New Year. Glad you guys could all make it safely here. Slip sliding around in there. Brand new year. I think this is always like a unique kind of time of year. You know, kids are getting ready to go back to school. There's a lot of big football games on TV, like one yesterday, which was pretty cool. We're all kind of like bracing ourselves to, you know, figure out what kind of winter we're going to have, impact of snow, that kind of thing. It just seems like there's always like a lot going on this time of year as we, you know, ease out of Christmas and, you know, we ease into a new year. And most importantly, you know, this is a time of year where everyone is kind of making sure their jeans still fit, because we know it's not the winter air that makes denim shrink, right? So good to check on that. And I also think it's interesting how, like, we as a culture kind of make a really big deal about celebrating the new year. You know, just like a couple nights ago, you know, most of us probably counted down the last few seconds of 2021. It just got me thinking about, like, the whole, like, New Year's Eve celebration thing. And then I stopped and thought for a second, like, what, man, this is a really big celebration for what? You know, what are we celebrating? Now, I know most people would say, well, we're celebrating, you know, the end of the last year and, you know, starting the new year off with a bang. And I get that. But it just kind of seems a little bit ironic that, you know, as Christians, just a week before we're celebrating the birth of our Savior who came to be our Messiah, you know, to save us from our sins. And then literally 1 week later, you know, there's another big celebration. And for some people, maybe even a bigger celebration for New Year's. It's just like, wow, where's all the people lining the streets to celebrate Christmas, you know? But it's just, I know I'm being a little facetious about this, but it's just kind of interesting sometimes when I think and stop about, you know, the thousands of people that gather in New York City and around the world, you know, for this big celebration. And then you see on TV, you know, there's a bunch of famous artists and they're all singing one after another, millions of people watching on TV to see, you know, the ball drop and everything, you know, and maybe it's tradition at this point, but regardless, you know, it's ingrained into our culture and in many cultures around the world for us to make this really big deal about the end of the year. And I'm not trying to be like a party pooper or anything, but I bring up New Year's Eve because, you know, it's still on our minds, and I actually have really fond memories of New Year's Eve. I want to tell a quick story here before we get started this morning, if that's okay. So when I was in college at Heidelberg, and then later on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ, every year right after Christmas was over, for about 4 or 5 years in a row, I would attend this huge 4-day Christian conference for college students that took place in downtown Indianapolis, Indiana. And this always took place right between Christmas and New Year's. I think it's had various names over the years, but it was usually known as Indianapolis Christmas Conference, or we called it NDCC for short. I think it might go by a different name now, maybe like Winter Conference or something like that. But anyways, this annual Christian conference for college students was for kids all over the Midwest, including Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, and Illinois. And it was a really big deal because, you know, we'd have roughly 2,000 college students and staff together that were there each year. And the cool thing about these conferences is that they left a really big impact on those that were there, myself included. And these were really, really fun times because you're there with a bunch of your friends from your ministry. You get to hang out in these really nice hotels. And more importantly, you get to worship God together in this huge crowd in a really fun setting. And then there are several other things that made it really memorable, but the worship and the messages were really awesome. The most challenging part of the whole thing was actually when we had to do outreach in some of the rougher areas of the city. We kind of partnered with local churches, and we handed out boxes of prepackaged food. And then after that, we would actually try to talk to people about Jesus on their own doorstep. If you've never done that, it is a very eye-opening experience, but very awesome, very well worth it, especially for me when I was a newer believer, very eye-opening. But there's always great stories that came from that. But the best part of the conference was the big finale at the very end, the New Year's Eve celebration. And this would always take place on the last night. You know, we get all 2,000 of the students and staff together in this giant conference room to bring in the new year. And what we did was we sat down and we watched TV together. I'm kidding. We didn't. We actually didn't watch TV at all. We actually would go up and we'd get all together, and then we'd get in small groups. We were kind of organized into smaller groups, and then we prayed. We prayed in the new year. We prayed for local communities, for states, for regions, for the country, and for the world. And after that, we would count down together, and then right at midnight, the best part was when the worship band played really loud, right at midnight, and we all kind of, we worshiped God for the next hour or two into the morning, and it was really incredible. It was a great way to end the conference. But I want to share that with you because, you know, we're talking about New Year's, and it really felt like for me, you know, going through that experience for 4 or 5 years in a row, it really felt like a small piece of heaven, what heaven will be like someday. You know, many people coming together to worship the Lord and just really on fire for Him. So it's hard to describe, but it was pretty amazing. But my mini point to that was that it really makes me wonder if the things that we celebrate in this world are just really worth all the praise that we get. When you think about our culture, there's just some things that get way too much credit. You know, I was going back to thinking about everyone in the streets in New York City. And then, you know, other things in our world that we celebrate like crazy, like movies, some music, sports even, celebration of self, celebration of science and art. And I mean, the list goes on and on, where all of these things are starting to take the place of what we really should be celebrating. And that the New Year's Eve celebration really got me thinking about that. So, and this has really been on my heart recently, as, you know, there's so much of, you know, what we're committed to in this life that can really be a distraction to what we should be paying attention to. You know, so much of our culture is committed to focusing on these distractions rather than putting the most important thing, Jesus, at the front and center. And I've just noticed that more and more as, you know, we continue each year, and it's been, you know, concerning to our world and to our future. And it's just something that I think that we're kind of going into with our new year. So you've probably noticed that Mike talked about the new series that we are in here starting today. And I think it's going to be a really, really good series because it is really addressing this new commitment to Jesus that we are starting in this new year. And I just really think that this is the time to really, like, if you're going to pick a time, this is it, you know? Because the overarching theme of this series that we're going to go through is that we as believers understand the importance of having a new passion, a new desire, a new commitment for Christ. And maybe for some people, maybe it's, you know, first-time commitment. So you'll notice that the graphic on the screen is kind of like a highway sign showing the direction for something new is this way. And I feel like that is like a direction for this is the way to new commitment, to new life with Christ is one of two directions. And the other thing I thought about was, you know, it's kind of like when you're driving down a highway and you see a sign for your exit and you know you have, you know, maybe at least a few seconds to start making the moves, maybe 30 seconds tops, to start making moves to get to where you need to be, depending on traffic, to get off on your exit in time. Because if not, if you linger or you think about it too much, if that's where you need to go, you could really easily miss your exit. But the thing I thought about with that is that the exit itself, it never moves. It's always there. It's us that's moving. It's us that's going too fast sometimes. But we still need to move ourselves accordingly to get to where we need to be. And you know, I think there's some double meaning in there that maybe Mark can talk about in the next week or so with the direction that we're taking this new series. But it really seems to me like the time is right for this new commitment when you consider, you know, all the changing and everything that's been going on in our world over the past few years and just how everything looks so different now. And I kind of mentioned this to the youth a couple months ago about the importance of taking our relationship with Jesus seriously. And I said to them, Jesus died and rose for your sins. So what? And I didn't mean so what, like who cares? I meant so what, like, so what does that mean to you? And I kind of just wanted to just straight up ask him and see what kind of response I would get. They were maybe a little taken back by that question, but it's a great question that we all need to ask ourselves every day. You know, Jesus died for our sins. So what? What does that look like in our lives? You know, if Jesus is everything to us, how do we show it? And that's the kind of question that I just kind of keep coming back to. You know, do we take our faith seriously? And if not, you know, what's holding us back? Is it a faith thing? Is it a fear thing? Is it a fear of the unknown? Is it a fear of change? What is it? So today we're going to talk a little bit more about how we can live our lives in faith and not in fear. Because there's no place for fear in our lives with Jesus at the center. And we look at some of the things that fear can do to us and some things that we need to avoid if we want to walk in faith with him. So we're going to look at that today. And I've noticed, you know, if you're going through life and you're missing the reason why we're here, missing the fact that we're all here for Jesus alone, we can end up having a life both of uncertainty and in fear, you know, whether we want to admit it or not. You know, and those things can kind of snowball into other problems. So today we're going to look at the Word, and we're going to look at how in the Word we find all kinds of people of faith and all kinds of people who are scared. They're all over the Bible. And there's one situation where both of those worlds are kind of colliding at the same time, and it's with God's people. Some are living in faith, some are living in fear. Most were living in fear. And one book where this actually all takes place is in the Old Testament. It's the book of Numbers. And before we get into that specific story, quick refresher on the book of Numbers. Maybe not a super well-known book compared to other books of the New Testament, like in the Gospel, but still very, very important. Near the beginning of the Bible, it's not long after the Exodus, where Moses leads roughly 2 million Israelites out of Egypt and into freedom and into the wilderness towards the promised land that God has for them. And that's kind of the overarching theme of a big chunk of the beginning of the Bible here. And since we're talking about faith today, it's important to point out that this entire book of Numbers is about faith, or lack thereof, from a lot of God's people. They needed the faith in him that it would take to reach the promised land, and so many didn't have it. So as they start out, they're leaving Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and all that, and the trip starts out. Things are going okay. Everyone is getting organized. All the tribes are, you know, marching and lined up right where they need to be, and the ark is in the right place with the Levites and all that stuff. And things are going great at first, but it does not last very long. Things start getting really ugly, and things take an ugly turn quick. There was a lot of Israelites who were not happy about being in the desert. they complained a lot to Moses, and they complained about what they ate. And they didn't not like the manna that God was providing for them. They were getting sick of it. And there was like all these other things that they were complaining about. So doubt was already like settling in. This uneasiness was like settling into God's people. And I mean, even Moses' own brother and sister, his own family, even started to question him and doubt him. And it was really, really weighing on Moses. But he stayed faithful, but the people were in a completely different place. So while all this was going on, you know, God's people are finally coming close to reaching the land of Canaan for the first time, which is, you know, the land that God has promised to the Israelites, the promised land. You know, this is potentially it. They need to just trust him for it. You know, this is a pretty short journey. You know, they're entering. But there's a few things that need to happen first before they can just go on in. So first, God told Moses to send out one leader from each of the 12 tribes of Israel as spies somewhat to explore and to scope out this land of Canaan that they just got to. And then they needed to report back what they found. So there's these 12 guys. Keep in mind, there was two of them by the names of Caleb and Joshua. So if you're not familiar with the story, those are two names to remember that'll be important for later. So after 40 days, these 12 guys are exploring this land. They come back and they report to Moses and Aaron and some of the community. And as they're reporting what they found, they are at first excited with the beauty of the land, and they spoke, you know, of what it looked like, but then they also started to speak in fear and doubt. So as we take a look at what they said that caused fear, we're going to be taking a look at how fear can cause problems. And this was a huge theme of what they found, and it was an overarching theme of their state of mind at the time. And this fear is causing problems, and we're going to look at that and how, in the first one, what they did was fear was overemphasizing the negative. And this is something that the group was very good at. So let's take a look at the first passage here in Numbers 13. We're going to read 27 and 29. It says, "They gave Moses this account. We went into the land which you sent us. It does flow with milk and honey. Here is the fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and their cities are fortified and very large, and even descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amortites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea along the Jordan." So they're reporting, and you know, they're at first kind of excited. And they're saying, yeah, it's great. Here's the proof. But they're also saying, well, this looks a lot more difficult than we originally thought. They're probably thinking, you can forget about living there. You can forget about us settling there. And the reason is, they're saying, look at all of these people that are already here. You know, and they're just kind of saying, well, you can forget about it. And they talked about these descendants of Anak who were very powerful, possibly very large warriors. And it doesn't say exactly how many they saw. They just know that these people were big, they were powerful, and they're saying, we're scared. And they're assuming that, hey, we have no chance of defeating them. Same goes for the other people in that area. So they're like, we have no chance. So it's easy to see that they're stacking the chips against themselves already. And I feel like that's a really easy thing to do. And as I was reading that, I thought, you know, this kind of reminds me of when I was watching Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Charlie just kind of, he's going through like this roller coaster of emotions. It's kind of interesting. Because at first, like, you know, he's really excited. He thinks he has a chance to win the golden ticket and to pull one out of a candy bar. and he's excited, and then he doesn't win, and then he gets down. And then at one point, he's just like, well, I have no chance. Just forget it. If you think I'm going to even try again, you can just count me out. I don't want to even try anymore. It's funny to think about that. It was like this worldwide lottery, and it takes place in his backyard, and he is like really down on himself that he's not winning. It's kind of funny. But he's like, yeah, just count me out. And it's ironic because he ends up winning, and he gets to go. But as I was reading that, I was thinking of that movie. But the Israelites were kind of doing the same thing. They were overemphasizing the negative. They weren't even trying. You know, they didn't believe that they had any chance of winning. So they were kind of overemphasizing the negative. And that brings us to the second problem that fear can cause, and that is when we underestimate the abilities that God has given us. And this is a tricky one because it's easy to do. You know, sometimes we'll see people on TV, maybe, you know, well-known Christians, and we'll see them singing beautifully or playing beautifully or preaching really effectively or something like that. And we'll say to ourselves, well, I don't think God has given me any of those gifts. Or even go as far to say, well, he probably hasn't even given me any gifts at all. And if you believe that, that's just simply not true. Because if you're a believer in Jesus, you have the Holy Spirit living in you, and he gives us these gifts to be able to serve God. And there's a bunch of different gifts that we can have. And it just so happens that, you know, some people have some gifts, some have others, but they're all given to us to glorify God. There's no right or wrong. You know, we need to remember that we have them to serve him and not to serve ourselves. And we need to not underestimate, you know, the abilities that God gives us. So I noticed that 1 Peter talks about this in chapter 4, verse 10. He says, as each has received a gift, use it to serve one another as good stewards of God's varied grace. So it's important to know that we all have the ability to serve God. But the Israelites were doubting their abilities. They're doubting their gifts. And they thought, you know, we have no chance. We're not even going to try. And then this is what it says in Numbers 13:31. It says, but the men who had gone up with him, they said, we can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. Then it goes on to say, in Numbers 13:32b, 33, they said, the land we explored devours those living in it, and all the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them. So this is not sounding like a group of men who are trying to make a good decision for the people as much as they're making a decision in fear and a decision in lack of faith regarding the size of their enemy. And, you know, maybe there were giant people, maybe there were strong people, but they are completely underestimating having an army of 600,000 men, and not to mention the fact that God is on their side. So their fear was causing a big problem. And as I was reading that, I thought, you know, for me, I was a guy who played basketball in high school, and I was on a not very good team. And I remember that even before the game started, so many of the guys on our team would just accept defeat before the game had even started. You know, we would sometimes think to ourselves, like, you know, this isn't going to go well for us. You know, we can't beat those guys. Look at how big they are. Look at how good they look. You know, we have no chance. And I remember that kind of attitude did not help us at all when it came to actually playing the game. You know, we were already at a huge disadvantage because of our lack of faith. And I was thinking about that, and I feel like that's kind of what we're seeing with these Israelites. They were saying, we have no shot at defeating these powerful people. They are giant and powerful. We're not. We're like little grasshoppers. And I noticed that their decisions weren't sounding like a people who had just witnessed God do some incredible things only like a year or two before when they were back in Egypt. All of the plagues, everything that happened, everything that Moses did through God, and then God parting the Red Sea for them to walk through dry land, and then God drowned the entire Egyptian army in it so that they could be free. And these people were completely forgetting some of these really important things that God had already done for them. So they were completely underestimating God. And that brings us to the third way of how fear causes problems. And that is that sometimes we can infect others with our own negativity. And just like we talked about with overemphasizing the negative, we can also spread negativity to others without even realizing it. We often think or say to ourselves things like this. We'll say, well, why can I ever? Or, why do these things always happen to me? Or, this never goes well. Or, why can't this person drive faster? Or, you know, all these little things, whatever it is, you realize that these little negative comments, they can add up when you focus on them, rather focus on the fact that you should be grateful for the things that God has put before you. And it's so easy to complain sometimes for about almost anything. And I know I catch myself doing it sometimes without even realizing it. And I know so many people who are so much better at me than at not complaining. I feel like I'm kind of a complainer. But one person who hardly complains at all, I'm going to pick on her for a minute, is my wife. And I don't know how she does it, but she hardly complains about a thing. And seeing that that type of example, it really has helped me grasp the fact that, you know what, no matter what the situation, complaining about it is never going to do much to change the actual circumstance of what you're complaining about. I mean, the only thing it's going to do is stress you out even more, and also it's going to distract you from the fact that you still need to find a solution to your problem. So it's doing all of these negative things at once. So I was thinking about that, and going back to the Israelite spies, I mean, these guys are starting to sound like the rest of the people who are complaining. So once they returned from the land, not only did they overemphasize the negative, they were spreading this negativity to all the other people about this land of Canaan, and they're trying to get, seems like, more people on their side. So listen to what it says in Numbers 13:32a. It says, and they spread amongst the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. Now remember, this is the land that God is giving them. And they're spreading a bad report about it. So, bad idea. Now keep in mind, these weren't just some random 12 men that were sent out on this 40-day mission. These were 12 of the highest leaders of the entire nation. They were leaders from one of each of the tribes. And God commanded that these leaders be sent out to this land. So what's happening here is that most of these leaders are starting to take this plan that God has formulated for them, and they're taking it into their own hands. And they're using negativity to make their point. And I think it was at this point where the Israelites' fear met their lack of faith, and this was really spreading. Now remember, people look to leaders, and they look to leaders they can trust. So as they're trusting these leaders, they're spreading a bad report, the people are buying into this. Then the people realize that, you know, if they realize that God had great plans for them, he was not going to lead them astray. These were God's own chosen people. This was not, you know, just one of many nations at the time. This was the nation. This was it. This was the group that God was with. His presence was there. The cloud by day, fire by night, the ark, the tent of meeting, the presence of the Lord. It was there. It was only the Israelites. This was God's people. No one else was. But the people were missing that. They didn't see that. They weren't seeing past their own situation and forget. They were completely forgetting about God. They were forgetting about their calling. And that can be easy to do sometimes. Though it would be about 700 years later, the prophet Isaiah would hear from the Lord, and he knew exactly how God felt about his people. Now listen to this in Isaiah 41, 8 through 10. It says, God says, "But you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend, I took you from the ends of the earth, from its furthest corners I called you. I said, 'You are my servant. I have chosen you and have not rejected you. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand.'" Wow, if only the people had knew that at the time. But God was talking through Moses. Moses was trying to convey that message to the people, but the people just were not getting it. Soon, because of their unbelief, God was about to act much differently towards his people, and we'll learn that here in a second. But that leads us to our last problem that we can have when living in fear, and that is it makes us grumble when things go bad. And now I'm not talking about like your stomach when you get really hungry and you get a little on edge or a little irritable. That's something completely different. That's called being hangry, which is a mix of the words hungry and angry, which if you haven't heard that before, it's a great word, and I use it a lot because whoever invented it, it makes a lot of sense. But I thought it was funny. I was thinking about the Snickers commercial, like, "You're not you when you're hungry." It's like, that's probably where that came from. But it's very well documented that, you know, these Israelites actually were kind of hangry at times in the wilderness. They were rejecting God's manna, and, you know, they were complaining about everything. But also for the Israelites, they were actually grumbling about the situation, meaning they were not happy with what's going on. They're grumbling amongst each other. They're grumbling to God. They hate the situation that they're in. And then finally, at this point, push came to shove with the Israelite people. Word had gotten around. Negativity had spread to everyone. And the people had finally had enough. So here's what it says in Numbers 14, 1 through 4. It says, "That night, all the members of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, 'If only we had died in Egypt or in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and our children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?' And they said to each other, 'We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt.'" So summed up, basically, they're saying that we hate the situation and we think we know better than God. And they think, "Oh, God brought us out here to die. He brought us out here to be killed." And it's amazing that they're thinking that after everything that God had done for them. It made no sense. After everything that Moses did through God, that he was doing for them, leading these people, it made no sense. They forgot everything. I mean, think about Moses. Like, he was directed by God, but he stuck his neck out for his people, saying to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." Now, Pharaoh was not just some random person. Pharaoh at that time was probably the most powerful person on the entire planet. And Moses, we know, was fearful of the situation. He had like a stuttering issue. He wasn't a good public speaker, but he did it anyway. And he knew even that very request, he could be killed by Pharaoh. But he also knew that God was with him the whole time. So had Moses not had the faith to overcome his fear, you know, it's possible that, you know, the Israelites could have remained slaves for longer, but God had this specific plan that it would be through Moses that they would be set free. But again, Israelites don't see that either. You know, they're only focused on their own situation. They're not seeing the big picture. This fear is just blinding them. This grumbling is blinding them. And I just think that's so crazy. Now, later in the New Testament, Paul tells the Philippians that grumbling is not what the children of God are known for. In Philippians 2, verses 14 and 15, he says, "Do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky." And those words are just so applicable today. You know, grumbling, negativity, fear, all these emotions, although common, get us nowhere. And that's what we're seeing, again, with God's people. So it seems like, at this point, all hope is lost. But let's go back, and let's see if there's any hope here. Let's see if there is anyone in this group of spies who was a voice of reason, a voice of truth. And if you aren't familiar how this story ended, I told you earlier to remember the names of Caleb and Joshua, as they would be important later. Well, these two guys ended up being very important because out of the 12 tribes' leaders, these were two guys who stayed faithful and they believed God was not leading them astray. And they helped give Moses the kind of leadership he needed. And God really took notice of this. These two guys walked in faith. So this is our antidote of sorts to all of these problems that living in fear can cause. When we walk in faith instead, we can see that what God has for us, and we can see his plan more clearly. So if we look back to Numbers 13:30, this is when the 10 other leaders thought that this nation had no chance at beating these giants or powerful men that they found in these lands. But the one who spoke up in faith completely disagreed. Here's what it says. "Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, 'We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it.'" Caleb's faith never wavered. He had faith in God the entire time when no one else did. When all these other leaders were acting in fear, he acted in faith. And that is a sign of a true leader. And Caleb, he was not acting alone. He had Joshua as well. And Joshua was on his side and believed as well. Listen to what it says in Numbers 14:6-9. It says, "Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, 'The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them.'" And it's clear that these guys know what they're talking about. You know, they're saying, "Do not be afraid. The Lord is with us." And you can tell that Joshua and Caleb are speaking very passionately to a group of guys that just simply are not getting it. They even tore their clothes, which in that culture is a sign or gesture of extreme disgust. They're saying, "Don't rebel. We can do this. We have God, remember?" But they don't hear that. And despite all of that, it just never set in. So much so that the rest of the group went the other direction. They even talked about stoning Caleb and Joshua for what they had said. And it was, and this was the last straw. This made God very angry at those who were not believing. This is the part where God told Moses he was ready to wipe out everyone and just restart with Moses. But then, obviously, he decided not to. So instead, their punishment was going to be for everyone to wander the desert for 40 years so that the adults would die in the desert. They would never reach the promised land. Their descendants would, their kids would, but they never would. And he's probably even taking that from what they said. God led us out here to die. Okay. So they would never make it. God said for 40 years, he would be against them and not for them. They would feel his wrath. So throughout the rest of this book of Numbers, many of God's people would actually continue to rebel. They would be like enemies. And God would not hold back on them. And so this cost many people their lives. We're not going to get into that today. But all this lack of faith from these 10 men that didn't believe spread to the rest of the nation. And even though there was all this anger and hardship, God said that for their faithfulness in him, Caleb and Joshua would not die in the desert like all the other adults. They would live long enough to dwell in the promised land. And they would remain leaders in the nation and see the people through to the other side. So it was very clear that, you know, their faith in the midst of so much fear and so much unfaithfulness was very admirable, and God took notice. And they were strong in the Lord when everyone else wanted to take the easy road. Many did not have the faith to stand and fight against the giant people, the giants that they saw. And if that story sounds familiar, it should, because several hundred years later, after this, a shepherd boy, who was also an Israelite, named David, would have the same faith as Caleb and Joshua when it came to fighting and defeating the giant Goliath. When no one else had faith in sight of this giant, David did. David never let fear even enter his mind when he prepared to fight the giant, because he knew that God was on his side. Unlike many of his ancestors in the desert, David knew God was on his side. Then several hundred years after that, when Jesus is born and he starts his ministry and he's teaching his disciples about what it means to have faith over fear, he taught them a very valuable lesson one night when all the disciples were on the boat and Jesus comes to them walking on water. And he calls Peter out of the boat to walk on water with him. And Peter began to walk towards him on the water, but then Peter got scared. He started to sink, and he asked Jesus to save him. And I love what happens next in Matthew 14, verse 31. It says, Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Why do you doubt?" That is an amazing question. Because even though Jesus already knew the answer for Peter, he still asks him. He knows that typically people don't walk on water. And he knows that Peter was scared when he came out. But he still asks, "Why did you doubt?" It makes me wonder if he was saying to Peter, like, "Don't you know who I am? You know, don't you believe who I am? Haven't I already proved myself to you many times over that I am who I say I am? Why are you scared? Do you really think I'd let you perish? Why do you doubt?" And the interesting thing is that it really seems like God was asking the Israelites in that same voice, that same exact question, 1,400 years before. He was asking, "Why do you doubt? Don't you know who I am? Don't you believe who I am? Haven't I already proved myself to you many times over that I am who I say I am? Why are you scared? Do you really think I'd let you perish? Why do you doubt?" And now here we are, some 2,000 years after the cross, and Jesus is still asking some of us that same question. Why do you doubt? Don't you know who I am? Don't you believe who I am? Haven't I proved myself to you many times over that I am who I say I am? Why are you scared? Why do you doubt? And that is really significant, because that's the question. That's the most important question there is. Do you believe in God? Do you believe that Jesus died for your sins, or do you still doubt? And that is why faith over fear is so important, because it all comes down to that. Do you believe in him, the creator of the universe, in Jesus, the King of Kings? If you haven't accepted Jesus as Lord in your life, there is never a better time than the present. So right now, we're going to do something just a little bit different. Rather than me closing in prayer, I'm going to ask Mike and the band to come back up in a minute. And they're going to do something just a little different. And they are going to just kind of start to play lightly. And again, instead of me praying, I want us all just to take a minute and just pray quietly at our seats. If you want to pray with someone next to you, please feel free. But we're just going to spend 30 seconds, maybe a minute or so, and just kind of reflect on who he is and what he has done for you. Or, you know, pray for whatever is on your heart, whatever God is putting there. If you know someone that doesn't know him yet, this is the time to pray for them. Maybe if you don't know him yet, if you've never taken time to pray to him, or maybe you haven't prayed in the new year yet for 2022, and you want to do that. Whatever it is, just we're going to take some time and just kind of sit in silence and just kind of reflect. Because no matter what types of fears or uncertainties that the world is going to try to throw at us, we need to always remember to walk in faith and to know that God is closer than we realize, and that he is not going to lead us astray. He is not going to lead us into a situation that is not good. But we need the faith to believe that. And remember that he is on our side, and he loves us more than we know. The thing is, we have nothing to fear when we put our faith in Jesus. Let's take just a minute and pray quietly. I really love that song, Walk by Faith, just because, not just because it's a great song, but because of the part where he says, help me to rid my endless fears. You've been so faithful for all of my years. And that is the truth, because we all have fears. We all have hurts. But God's grace is so much bigger than all of that. He has new mercies for us every day, because we serve an amazing and awesome God. So I just want to encourage everyone just to live in faith this year in 2022, and to spread that faith to others. Thanks for coming. Have a great week. Happy New Year. God bless.